who wants to own title to a part that has to cross the border three times before it gets put into a car, because nobody knows who's going to be paying the tariff and what the risk of that tariff is and who is going to bear it. And our channel checks have been flagging serious recession risk since about early February. Supply chains, many critical supply chains have begun to seize in a way not seen since COVID. That doesn't mean that they're on the same scale as COVID. But, you know, uncertainty in just-in-time manufacturing is not conducive to growth.
Welcome back. This is Raise Your Average. I'm Pierre Daly. Co-hosting with me is Mike Philbrick. And joining us is Doomberg, the illustrious head of the Doomberg Collective.
This is Raise Your Average, dedicated to making you a better long-term allocator and investor and making complex investing topics understandable. Join us as we sit down with some of the most interesting names in finance to discuss topics like macro, markets, investment strategy, ETFs, and more. Subscribe to learn along with us.
Doomberg, welcome back, and thank you so much for joining us. It is terrific to have you. How are you doing?
I'm doing wonderful, Pierre. Mike, great to be back with you. It's always a really insightful and enjoyable conversation, and I have a pretty strong suspicion that given the speed and volatility of the headlines, this one will be no different.
The timing is perfect. I mean, boy, what a tricky and trying and especially busy time this past quarter has been. Today is April 2nd. So much to talk about. You know, we've now become accustomed, I think, to the most, to the almost daily shrill sound of Sharpies performatively scratching across freshly printed edicts, detailing how things are going to be. Tariff threats, energy policy, the wholesale unwinding of U.S. government departments and military support, for starters, and lots of what appear on the outside to be unintended consequences, but are starting to actually feel like the intended consequences of the new White House, the intended squeeze plays. Maybe the pressing place to begin is with WrestleMania, with your piece on auto tariffs.
Yeah, sure. Well, first of all, thanks for having a U.S.-based author on. I know that's probably a risk at the moment, seeing some of you all based in Canada. It's funny, covering Trump, and I'll get to WrestleMania in a second, but I do think it's worth it to say a few words.
Please. Yeah.
We have a four-day editing cycle. So, you know, we have to research, write, edit, publish, promote, and defend a piece roughly every 4 days. And it's been challenging in the Trump era because what we call internally headline risk has never been higher. You know, you could have what you think is a great piece ready to go, and it's set to publish at 7 a.m. and the wires crossed the night before, and everything that you've written is now made moot by some 180-degree policy change. And I could only imagine what it's like to be running a large multi-billion-dollar multinational business like automaking,
yeah,
which was really the genesis of the motivation for us to write WrestleMania. Because who wants to own title to a part that has to cross the border three times before it gets put into a car? Because nobody knows who's going to be paying the tariff and what the risk of that tariff is and who is going to bear it. And our channel checks have been flagging serious recession risk since about early February. Supply chains, many critical supply chains have begun to seize in a way not seen since COVID. That doesn't mean that they're on the same scale as COVID. But, you know, uncertainty in just-in-time manufacturing is not conducive to growth. And unintended or intended, which we can talk about, the main thrust of WrestleMania is that we're heading to a recession, and we're wondering whether the big three U.S.-based automakers can survive in their current form, which is a bit of a long-shot call, which we like to do. But this is the pattern that we're seeing, and the thesis of it is, you know, we read this great piece by Jim Grant, Grant's Interest Rate Observer, really one of the best in the business, and he had what I thought was the most balanced and insightful assessment of Trump, the man and the politician, beginning with this amazing story of Trump saving this, you know, skating rink in Manhattan.
Yeah.
and how he was able to get everything done so quickly, but also spun it to his advantage, you know. And Trump is all of those things. He is vain. He is bombastic. He is patriotic. He is fancies himself a brilliant negotiator. He is correct in the diagnosis of what ails the U.S., I believe, and probably correct in the path out. I think he is underestimating the friction of the transition and the timing mismatch between administering the medicine and whether the patient dies on the table or not. He has a very limited window politically of relatively strong support in the U.S. compared to the 50-50 polarization that we've experienced in the past. And if that window slips through his hands, it could be very challenging for him. And we view the victory automakers in the U.S., you know, as we said in the piece, Trump is the type of person who thinks that a country isn't a real country unless they build their own cars with, you know, patriotic local hands. And those cars are fueled by domestically produced gasoline. And maybe you drill a hole in your muffler to make it sound a little louder as you speed away from the red light. And so, and that's all fine. And that resonates with flyover country. Trump connects with average U.S. voters in a way that is very difficult for people outside of the country who don't live here to understand. And we have many, many friends in Canada, and literally they call and say, you know, are you going to move? You know, like, but they just don't understand the level of support that he has internally. So he's a very complex figure. He is taking a sledgehammer to a problem that probably needs one. But the timing of the sort of boom that comes out of it, because I do think there's a world where if the federal government is shrunk, that's going to cause a recession. If regulations are removed and investment is encouraged, there will be a V-shaped sort of recession where you come out as fast as you went in. But let's not kid ourselves. I mean, if depending on what happens today, and Lord knows this is one giant headline risk for this podcast, we're going to see a recession, and there's going to be a recession in Canada as well. So.
Well, I mean, if you like the term, I mean, the search for the word recession has been trending. So a lot of people are on that.
Yeah. Again, we're pretty well connected to industry. I think that's the inefficiency in the content world, the financial content world that we occupied when we started Doomberg 4 years ago. And we get a lot of intel, you know, right. We have friends in various C-suites, and you can always tell at the front end of the supply chains when things are going to get haywire. You know, Amazon knows long in advance when recessions are going to come because they have incredible. Walmart knows, you know, the chemical companies know. They can see the order book, how the quarter looks. And I think the sort of the steel, like who wants to, like just the threat of tariffs on steel disrupts so much. Like who wants to hold title before it crosses the border? How do you plan 15 weeks in advance? Not knowing whether the tariff is going to be not there, 50%, 25%, or 500%. Now, imagine, you know, semiconductors.
Yeah.
You know, imagine appliances. Imagine, like, there's 30,000 parts in a car. And each of those parts have their own independent supply chains. They have to qualify, you know, as automotive grade. Such qualifications are usually done at the factory level. So if you build a new factory, you're not, that factory isn't, you know, a priori pre-qualified as a supplier to Ford. Trump just assumes that all of these factories will be relocated in time to avert a recession, right? It's just that there's a timing mismatch here that's just not being considered. And I do think another thing we mentioned in this article is, yes, you know, the Chinese have done all the things that we have chronicled and others have accused them of doing. But one wonders whether technologically they haven't reached escape velocity anyway. You know, BYD is just producing such amazing vehicles for such low prices, it boggles the mind. And the major companies, the Fords, the GMs, the Chryslers, are capitalized to compete globally. So there's only so much the American market now even still means. As we said in the piece, it's pretty amazing when you look at the data. The number of passenger vehicles sold in the U.S. is the same as it was in 1986. The It's when Hulk Hogan was, you know, body slamming Andre the Giant. And
WrestleMania one.
Yeah. Oh, it's, I mean, who didn't grow up on that, you know, and then Mike Tyson's punch out shortly thereafter. So that, you know, it is, Trump is fascinating in a way. He's fantastic for content, but he's also quite frustrating to cover as well.
Absolutely. So now in your piece, you detailed, six reasons why, you know, Trump's auto tariff strategy and tariff strategy in general, but auto tariff strategy specifically could backfire. What are some of those, you know, what are those?
Sure. So I'll list them and then we could talk about whichever one catches your interest. But the first is what I just described, which is the U.S. domestic vehicle market is just not as relevant as it once was. And if you threw up a 10,000% tariff, the rest of the world's auto market would still be good enough for those companies. It would put the Germans in a world of hurt and the Canadians and the Mexicans, of course. But, you know, at 16 million units moved, the same number as 1986. I mean, this is not the dominant market it once was. The second is what I also alluded to, is what does it even mean to manufacture a car in modern times? Long gone are the days where nothing but raw ingredients went into Henry Ford's kitchen and out came a car from the oven. The supply chains are just incredibly complex. And then the timing mismatch that I referred to. The third challenge is the friction of the transition. Like if you go into a recession, in a deep one, engineers would joke, and it's a joke we use, is that you only need one zero and a geometric mean to know what the answer is. And you know, if these companies default, well, of course, you know, they've gone bankrupt before, at least GM and Chrysler have. But I mean, I don't know that the solvency of the big three is on anybody's radar at the moment. And then China can retaliate. That's the fourth reason. Tesla is intimately tied to China, and General Motors, they move more volumes in China than any other country save for the U.S. Another headwind facing the industry, although again not directly tied to tariffs, is Trump's complete abandonment of the electric vehicle push that Biden and Obama and, you know, left-leaning states around the country have been leading on the automakers so hard to do. And that's stranding billions of dollars of investments and, you know, causing plans to be ripped up. And all this is expense, right? I mean, it eats away at the equity of the company. And then the final one is China's just superior. They make better products for far cheaper. They churn out more innovative products more quickly at prices that just confound people. And by the way, we've written a half a dozen pieces warning about this over the past 18 months, and to see it come to fruition. I mean, we're recording this on a day where Tesla shocked the market to the downside on deliveries, and BYD is crushing it. And one of the charts that we keep a close eye on here is the ratio of the market cap of Tesla divided by BYD, because that's an interesting assessment of the state of froth in the U.S. markets. And that's a chart that I would suggest listeners pull up on their Bloomberg and keep an eye on over time. So those are the six reasons. Happy to take it in any direction that Mike or Kerry out of you want to go.
I'm shocked. So we should have vehicle production that's 1986 levels. I definitely did not know that.
Yeah.
And then you've got this. So you've got how much of the drive to electric cars is an attempt to drive towards renewables, which, I mean, you've been pretty savage on renewables, and I don't know, offshore wind is like the fire festival of energy policies. But how are they connected? How is the renewable drive and the electrification and the sort of the battery operated cars and that sort of thing? What's the connection?
Sure, I would bifurcate the world of electric vehicles between China and everybody else, and in China, they make perfect sense. China has two major threat to the CCP challenges, and they address threats to the CCP challenges with major initiatives. Those two threats are, one, pollution in the big cities, and two, a shortfall of crude oil, which they've tried to paper over with a vast excess of refining capacity so that if they get shorted crude, at least their neighbors are in the hurt locker with them. And electric vehicles in Shanghai make perfect sense across both of those dimensions. EVs do work pretty well in cities. You don't want to drive from Michigan to Texas in one. But if you're doing a 50-mile daily commute and you have access to a plug, in a relatively decent climate like Shanghai, they're perfectly fine. And they reduce pollution. I mean, I remember traveling to Shanghai and Beijing and you know, PM2.5 numbers that the U.S. Embassy was leaking onto the Chinese internet were all the rage, and people were following them because it was, you know, 300 PM2.5. And for those that are unfamiliar, that's particulate matter below certain micron or above a certain micron. I forget the exact measurement, but it's a proxy for pollution. And so what we're seeing is LNG trucks taking over for diesel, and we're seeing electric vehicles take over for passenger cars. And that makes perfect sense for China. It makes no sense in the U.S. And to mask it as sort of the green renewable agenda only serves China's purposes even more, because they have monopoly control over the key supply chains that feed solar and wind. And so it's a perfect, you know, we have this pro tier for Doomberg Beyond our articles. And last year, our most popular pro presentation that we put out was called Year of the Dragon, China Through the Lens of Energy. And if you do a detailed analysis of the strategic approach to China, if you were dealt their cards, this is exactly what you would do. And it's brilliant. And they've executed it. So you're seeing the only real market where EVs are still having substantial growth is in China. And as China always does, the domestic champions are dominating. So, like, I think Tesla's a fraction of a, you know, has a fraction of the market share of EVs in China. And by the way, BYD has innovative plug-in hybrid technologies, which I think will be sort of how you drive from Beijing to Shanghai in these cars if you need to. And so EVs have nothing to do with renewables. It is a Chinese domestic need, and the rest of the world has been fooled into trying to compete on China's terms. That's our view.
I think a pretty unique take for sure. And why would we do that? Why would we fall prey to that?
We have lots of questions about the capability and culpability of the last decade and a half of Western leadership. If you just take a step back and look at the demise of Europe, what Germany's doing, the knots Canada has tied itself into, where the U.S. has headed, I don't know. And we often are asked whether it is competence or malice. I prefer to live in a world. That's a distinction with one important difference, because intent does matter. Intent signals that the system could correct itself. So we prefer to live in a world where incompetence is the root cause, because malice is a much harder and more violent problem to overcome. I mean that like literally.
Yeah.
It tends to lead to revolutions. And what we're seeing in Europe, by the way, with this whole, you know, saving democracy by disqualifying and jailing candidates you don't like, is shocking, quite frankly. The current president of the United States had 30 felonies. Right? It remains to be seen what happens in Europe. But the one big difference between North America, Canada, and the U.S. is we're just so much energy abundance, and they have energy poverty. So we have far more room for error in this regard.
Right. You raise an excellent point, and one that I think is, systemic, pervasive. Like, I don't think people understand at all where things come from. They think that energy just shows up in their wall, and their computer runs and their phone charges, and they really don't have any idea from the person in their bedroom in the morning to the leadership in the U.S. and some of the Western world. Like, it's such a problem that you point out, and we've kind of been duped into competing in China's terms. We don't have to, and we don't know any better.
I'll give you a perfect example of this, Mike. China is gorging on coal while the rest of us have been taught to get off it. And China is plugging in its EVs into the coal plants, right? I mean, literally, they're powering their vehicles on coal, because you can have the coal plants outside of the cities and you can implement pollution controls. And so you just move the pollution to a point source, which makes it far more economically viable to, like, China produces more than half the world's coal. and they still import because they produce more than they burn, and they still import because they're stockpiling. They learned the lessons of the European energy crisis of 21 through 23. And so, to your point about people not knowing where stuff, you know, we literally, one of the most popular pieces we wrote in 2021, when we realized that maybe Doomberg could be a thing, was a piece called Where Stuff Comes From, where we just talked about how, like, the material science and chemical sectors slide down the energy curve, starting with very high energy materials and slowly partially oxidizing them. And, you know, you go from ethane to ethylene to polyethylene to, you know, maybe stick an oxygen atom on it and polymerize it a bit. And next thing you know, you have glycols and you have de-icing fluids, and all the stuff of society comes from barrel of oil, or more and more recently NGLs and things like that. And yeah, people just don't realize. And by the way, the North America, because I think we need to bifurcate the Western world now into three.
Yeah.
There's North America, there's Europe, and there's Asia. And all three are undergoing a major change in the Trump era. And Trump is focusing on the Western Hemisphere, which was our last Doom Zoom, our pro-tier presentation was called All You Can Eat Oil and Gas in the Western Hemisphere. Because we got plenty here,
you know,
to quote a famous Canadian politician. And so, you know, the Western Hemisphere, North America in particular, has been saved from such incompetence by two things. Property and mineral rights in the U.S. and Alberta's control over its own resources. So if you didn't have Texas and Alberta, everything would be California and Ontario, right?
Right.
Or California and Massachusetts. At least Ontario has nuclear, so I give Ontario a pass. And Quebec has hydro. But absent Alberta and Texas and Oklahoma and North Dakota, where would North America be? We would be Europe. Like an energy vassal subject to the whims of the Middle East. And in fact, as we showed in that presentation, the Western Hemisphere is already outproducing the Middle East, both in oil and by even wider margins in natural gas. And that's only going to continue. And so because there's state control over resources in the U.S., as long as it doesn't cross a state line, and you have property and mineral rights owned at the individual level, those two artifacts in the U.S., they're really quirks. Very few countries have this. That's why you have shale. And now shale is spreading all over the world. So Argentina and so on. And so all of those technologies become easier for multinationals to deploy. They would never invent them. But this is why you have, you know, Guyana being developed and so on. Because, like, that's not homegrown domestic technology. That's just deep water drilling and all the other things that, you know, largely the U.S. has developed, and then other countries take advantage of. And when I say the U.S., I mean the U.S. and Canada. The North American company is pretty dynamic. There will come a time where Canada and the U.S. kiss and make up again, I think relatively soon.
Of course. So. Yeah. In the construct that you, like, so we talk about, is it incompetence or is it sort of evil doing? And the challenge is, I wonder, like, is it incompetence for people to be misled to the point where, you know, sustainability is like, you know, when I talk to my 20-something kids, it's like vibes, it feels good, but it has no basis in sort of the thermodynamics that you talk about. And you've done a great job of highlighting just, you know, one lineup of those thermodynamic rules. And so we've got, is there a way, is that what Trump's doing? Is he re-educating society on hydrocarbons and the North American role within that and how rich we are in that sense?
So there's a challenge is that he's so polarizing that whatever he says, half the country is not going to listen to. And the country, sort of the half of the country that needs to listen to it is probably the ones that are going to be turned off because of the messenger.
And this is what I'm chatting with people. I face this regularly.
Right. It's called Trump derangement syndrome. They don't like that label, and we're not assigning it to them. I'm just telling you what other people call it. And again, anytime we write critically about Trump, we get waves of malcontent in our comments and things. And it's just a polarizing figure. And as analysts, our objective is to try to understand reality, truth, data, pieces on the board. If, you know, Harris had won the election, we'd still be writing our articles. And managing our portfolios, and you just have to operate with the pieces on the board. And Trump won. And so, okay, we have to analyze Trump. What does it mean? So to your point, though, this is why at the beginning of the war in Ukraine, when you had the sort of Peter Zeihans of the world saying that Russia would not be able to keep its oil and gas going, what are we smoking? Their education system has not devolved to the point that ours have. China has a petroleum engineers university with 15,000 enrollees. We produce 600 a year. Russia has got amazing universities and like great technology, and they're self-sufficient. Like they're a global superpower. I don't know when we forgot that Russia was a global superpower. And so we are coasting on the luxuries of wealth that have been produced in prior generations. That's my honest, uncynical view. Yeah. It used to mean something to get, a degree in engineering from a top school in Canada still has the British system, and so it's not gone yet. Although when we mentioned Canada's education system favorably in a piece, we did get some pushback from some Canadians. But you could get a degree in the U.S. today, and it doesn't mean what it did 25 years ago. I mean, it just doesn't. And anybody who thinks it does is fooling themselves. And so, you get a degree from Fudan University in Shanghai, that tells me something. You get into IIT India, that tells me something. And so, yeah, they at a minimum, look, what does it shock me that China's more than caught up in AI and using homegrown chips to do it? No, I mean, we've been calling this for years. It's naive to think that the Chinese are somehow behind us technologically. They just aren't. It's empirically demonstrable. Like we need to scramble our axioms here and better connect them to reality, because if we're going to, chart a better path, we can't be deluded. The reason why the sanctions war not only failed, but backfired, is because we just underestimated the enemy.
Yeah. I mean, there's
definitely there's another point to you.
There's, yeah, hubris, right? I mean, total overconfidence in American exceptionalism is one area that you can point to. And I just, like to your point earlier about, the time constraint of, half of a single term left for Trump, assuming, he doesn't somehow change the Constitution or waive the two-term limit or succeed in waiving the two-term limit. The idea that you can upend the previous paradigm for, a new one, for this new regime that Trump is trying to put in place. And again, to your point, again, it's either really stupid to think that you can do it all at once without it having some very dire ramifications for the economy, or is it calculated, or is it really, is there some malice? Is there some calculation in there for some other agenda? And so, I can't help thinking, like, that's the question that keeps going around, right? Is either this is either he absolutely they don't know what they're doing, or they do.
So that is a question du jour. My honest view is that he is well intended and he thinks he knows right. And the reason why we framed the entire WrestleMania piece about this yearning to get back to the golden era of the 1980s, Ronald Reagan and Mike Tyson and Hulk Hogan, and even the big three automakers with the K car, and Ford launched the Taurus, which will go on to be a great bestseller. There's a yearning to go back to, and his whole theme is make America great again, right? Like, yeah, the again part that we are questioning. Like, can you undo 40 years of deindustrialization in half a term without spending such a high amount of political capital that you effectively lose the ability to finalize it? And the only, credit where credit is due, we've been flagging this, but we're a blog on Substack. But I did listen to Danielle Smith, the premier of Alberta. She was interviewed by the Center for Strategic and International Studies, I think, a show called Power Map. And she's the one politician I've heard make the point that we've been trying to make, which is the capital planning cycle of the energy and other heavy industries is longer than the political cycle of the U.S.
Nice.
And it's told visually from her perspective through the arc of the Keystone Pipeline journey. And Trump, hey, let's do it again after 4 years of Biden killing it in his first week. It just doesn't work that way, right? Like, it's not bankable. There's a word that's used in industry when you're trying to develop a new technology. Is this bankable? Right. And in fact, suboptimal technologies that are bankable often win market share over experimentally superior technologies because they're not yet bankable. And what do I mean by bankable? Can I finance it? Are the risks known? What's the largest example of this technology that has been implemented in the world? Can I go look at it? Has it been running for any, you know, like it's very difficult to finance billions of dollars. Look, the second LNG export facility that takes advantage of the new gas link pipeline is going to be a lot easier to bank than the first one was, right?
Right.
And the 30th one built on the Gulf Coast is going to be a lot easier. I think so. This is what I mean by bankability. Well, when you have whiplash baked into the economic, the political system, because we're in a temporary period of ascendancy for those on the right. And the U.S. is a buffered system. It always reverts, right? It is challenging for the people who have to decide to invest billions and then raise the funds to do it and then get the permits to do it and get the thing built in time to earn a reasonable cost of capital when you have such a whiplash going on. Again, the political cycle is shorter than the capital cycle, and that's not conducive to capital formation and deployment.
Yeah, that reminds me of the, you know, the idea that China, you know, the sort of truth that China has been playing a very long game, and their attitude is, you know, when they're looking at who's in power, their attitude is, you know, when you're gone, we'll still be here.
Oh, 100%. And that actually trickles down to the corporate world too, right? But like Xi Jinping is if you cut a deal, like if Putin and Xi cut a deal to do Power Siberia 2, which I'm always sort of on the lookout for because I think that would be a transformative decision for the energy markets. Their words are money good. Like those permits are going to get issued. And pipe is going to get late. There's just no doubt about it. So if Saudi Arabia decides to develop its natural gas resource base, would you think that Greenpeace is going to get in the way? Of course not.
Maybe not anymore. Maybe not anymore ever.
That was one of our favorite pieces to write too, which we could probably get into. But my point is, like, who is going to bank a revival of the Keystone Pipeline project? Right. And so it is only things that are contained within Texas or contained within Oklahoma or Alberta or, you know, the things that do get built. And we could talk about what the future of Alberta energy is in a Carney world, too. I mean, there's lots of places we can go with this. But it is a under acknowledged risk of those who are particularly enthusiastic about the about face that has just occurred. And by the way, as much as we think the wind industry was a dumb idea, we have sympathy for the players involved. They went from, we need to do, you know, 30 gigawatts of offshore wind to nothing, like on the basis of the votes in seven states. And that's like not conducive to the U.S.'s reputation as a place that's friendly for capital. There are second and third order impacts here. Yeah, go ahead, Mike.
Yeah. Well, on the idea of bankability, does that relate as well as a subscriber to Doomberg and on the pro tier as well? You went through some of the, like, resources aren't just about where the resource is. Resources aren't about the geological formations and where they may exist. There are a number of other more important items, which I think yes. bankability relates to, as well as, you know, sure, I'll leave it. You take it from here, if you can, and just maybe talk through that.
Sure. So it was in that piece, All You Can Eat, oil and gas in the Western Hemisphere. And the point, one of the big points that we make in that presentation is, first of all, the world is swimming in hydrocarbons. Like the people who are peddling the myth of peak cheap oil or peak cheap gas are either deeply dishonest or deeply ignorant of the realities of the ground. And there's no other way to say it at some point. I mean, you have to just look around. You start with resources, right? And then those become reserves. Well, how does a resource become a reserve? It becomes a reserve because a company, state-owned or independent or some hybrid of that, invests money to validate that the resource is recoverable with existing technology and then viable given the economics to actually do it and earn a reasonable cost of capital. So you have a giant resource base, then you have a subset of resource bases that have been determined to be reserves, and then you have a subset of those who get exploited. And by the way, people don't typically categorize a resource as a reserve unless they have some line of sight to develop them, because it costs money to drill and to scan and to, you know, send your geologists out to the field and stake claims and all of those things, right? So now you have reserves. And we put this great chart in this presentation, the 100-year chart of U.S. crude oil proven reserves. It's 10 times production with an R squared of 0.92. Like, look and you will find. And now, why do reserves get exploited? Well, back to the question of bankability, one of the things you need is a permissive regulatory environment. Another thing that you need is a critical mass of service providers that de-risk the entire affair. And so right now, the incremental cost of being in the Permian is incredibly low. Hey, we got a produced water issue. Well, there's 10 companies trying to solve your produced water problem, right? Look, we have a pipeline offtake capacity. Well, they're building a bunch of pipelines. If you have the critical mass of support services, engineering firms show up in a locale, what typically happens is everybody goes and drills there and you drain the reserve. And then you go on to the next one. It's sort of a roving pack of wolves, right? And maybe they eat all the bears in one forest, but then there's lots of forests in the world and they move on. Maybe they get invited to a different forest because the government would like to control the bear population. So look what's going on in Argentina today. The resource base of Vaca Muerta, which is the giant shale play in Argentina, is enormous. Every bit as good as the Permian. Okay. Now, what's the regulatory environment? Well, Argentina for a century has been a basket case. Milei has arrived. If Milei is successful and sustainable, and the political cycle in Argentina is long enough to develop that critical mass, like we wrote a piece on Vaca Muerta, called Cash Cow from memory, because Vaca Muerta means dead cow in Argentinian. So that resource could produce 5-6 million barrels a day of oil if the right regulatory environment were there with the right critical mass of infrastructure providers and service providers. Now, it won't, but it's going to see 1 million barrels a day. And so in a world where we actually temporarily ran dry of oil and prices spiked, a whole lot of regulatory permission would be granted and a whole lot of people would be getting into the critical mass of infrastructure and services business because it would be lucrative to do it. And so what's never constraining and won't be in our lifetimes is the resource base. And when we categorized all of the massive resource base just in the Western Hemisphere, who could listen to that presentation and think that we're anywhere near peak cheap oil? So just take Venezuela. Venezuela is the largest hydrocarbon deposit known on the planet. It should be Canada. Very similar, right? Heavy, slightly different chemistry. What's the difference between Canada and Venezuela? Relative political stability and respect for contract law. That's it. That's the difference between 5 million barrels a day and one. Right? And what's Trump doing? He's trying to overthrow Maduro. And they're going to try to take over that resource base. And the sort of multipolar world, which means something different for the U.S. than it does for China and Russia, but nonetheless, a retreat out of, you know, European politics and maybe reach a deal with China and focus on the Western Hemisphere. Well, Venezuela is right there, produces the oil that the refiners in the U.S. need. And it's a giant Mexico, another one. I mean, Argentina, Brazil with the pre-salt formations. And like we're putting together a doom zoom on Africa here in the coming weeks or months. You know, when the continent separated, what Brazil has is also off the coast of Africa. And so like, there's just so much oil, and we have lots of friends in industry, and anytime somebody puts a high profile peak this or peak that pronunciation out there, my phone lights up. And one of them in particular often says to me, I'll give you two quotes. One is an oil person. And he says, look, when we need to get it, we know where to go find it. Like they have 50-year plans. Like they know where the resources are that could easily be converted to reserves. And then all of their friends join the party and they get critical mass and they produced. We have a good friend who's been early in the shale gas business and a veteran of the shale gas business. And anytime we write about gas, I like to send them the piece ahead of time to do a sanity check, you know, because it's good to have somebody with a little more direct expertise check your work before you publish it to hundreds of thousands of people. And the standard answer is I don't know much about gas, but we got way too much of it. Like we're just swimming in natural gas. And the point we made in a piece, just to give you one last sort of commentary on your question. Like we wrote a piece recently making the case that the U.S. is nowhere near a peak natural gas production. And there's all this talk about shale rolling over and, you know, we call them the well counters, you know. They're looking for the decline rates of various wells. They're studying parts of the bark of a tree and making a call in the forest. And so the piece we wrote was called Full Tank. Let's look at the Permian today. In the Permian, natural gas is a nuisance. It's often given away, negatively priced, literally pay people to take it. Why is it a nuisance? Because oil is overpriced because of OPEC. And so what has been going on in the last decade is all of the low gas to oil ratio wells are being produced, right? Like these are the tier one assets. Part of the tiering of the assets is the amount of gas that's anticipated to come up when you drill. And so the low GOR wells are being depleted in the minds of people. And yet we went from, you know, 4 to 20 BCF per day of natural gas in the Permian on a straight line up. What happens if natural gas is worth more than oil in a world of AI where you have distributed AI pods and you don't need to worry about LNG export terminals and things like that? All of a sudden, all those high GOR wells, and there's an endless supply of them, become tier one assets and get developed. Like the US today produces 100 BCF per day, which is an enormous amount of natural gas. We could do 150 if the market was, well, you know, if the market asked for it. We are drowning in gas in the Permian and it's free. What happens if it's valuable?
Yeah.
And we make it on purpose, you know, like with this whole ability to sort of think laterally about a problem. Like it won't always be that natural gas is cheap. And in fact, the co-production of gas with oil is what will undo OPEC, because we will find use for the gas, which will undermine the use for oil. And OPEC has been artificially chipping away at its own Jenga tower, and soon the whole thing will collapse. And so this understanding of how a resource becomes a reserve that becomes a producing well is lost on even people who claim to be energy experts sometimes.
Yeah, so we have this massive supply, and it will be brought online. So what does that say about the price of natural gas? Like, I can see both ways. Is there a floor that we're going to get from all the consumption? And then lastly, I'd love you to spend a minute or two just talking about abiotic oil and the idea that, you know, where we thought oil came from is not really where it came. That might round out the sort of supply issue, if you will.
And just annoy everybody listening before we're done at some point.
This is what I like. I like to hear stuff that's annoying.
Yeah, by the way, we'll talk about abiotic oil later. Here's how energy works. Energy is life. The demand for energy is infinite. Energy is fungible. In the short term, demand for energy is highly inelastic. But over time, supply and switching snuffs out any crises that may appear. So what you have over time, drawn over 50 years, is a upward-facing sine wave that goes up and to the right. Okay? And investors always draw tangent lines to sine waves. And because of the inelasticity issue, when we're short energy, which happens because of the mismatch between the business and political cycles and the capital cycles, people think we're running out of this stuff and they just go all in. And then that's the easiest trade to fade. So our advice to people, not that we give it, it's much easier to fade a spike in energy than to bet on its timing, to bet when it's going to happen. But you always fade Icarus Prince in energy because inevitably a combination of new supply and switching happens because of the fungibility issue. And so that's just how we look at markets. And so what does it mean for price of natural gas? Well, it means it's going to be too low for too long. And then there's going to be a wave of demand just as the shut-ins happened. And it's going to correct, and then all that supply is going to come back online, and it's going to be an up and to the right on consumption. Another axiom of energy is that industry are technological superpowers, and so the break even cost of natural gas right now is $2.5 per million BTU in the Marcellus. That's $12 a barrel oil. That's like cheaper than Saudi oil. At their major fields. We're going to find stuff to do with that natural gas, right? And in the long run, everything will sell for the same price corrected for energy content and logistics. This is just the giant arbitrage of energy. Now, there will be spikes. They should be faded. And there will be gluts, and they probably shouldn't be bought. That's our view, because gluts can last for a very long time, and spikes never do. So if all you ever did was put your money in T-bills and then buy a six-month put when oil is three times what it was 12 months ago, you're probably going to make a pretty good return. And if you've been in the industry, as I have, you know that you make all your money in like 25% of your quarters. And so trying to time when those quarters are going to materialize or just reacting to them, that seems like a simple choice. But yeah, we're bullish. We were bullish natural gas at $1.50 in April. And we're still pretty bullish natural gas because the ratio of the price of oil to the price of natural gas is still above where it should be. And there's a demand story that is believable that is still playing out, which is AI. But we're less bullish at $4 than we were at $1.50, sure. But if natural gas goes to 10, by the way, which is sort of the equilibrium price for landed LNG compared to sort of where we think Brent would trade in a OPEC free world, the U.S. would be literally we would be drowning it. Like we could produce so much more than we're producing. In that piece, Full Tank, which we published a few weeks ago now, I pinned the top comment because it's a petroleum engineer or exploration geologist. And he says, and I quote, "And trust me, as an exploration geologist with 30 years experience in shale drilling, there is no geologic constraint on natural gas on the horizon." And he goes on to say, at $7 a million BTU, you know, there's just a tsunami of gas. So what happens is price goes too low. Producers hold back. They grind away at technology to try to stay in business to be ready to take advantage of the good times when they come, because everybody in the industry knows that you have to make hay while the sun is shining. And then they hunker down for the next one. And meanwhile, retail investors are drawing tangent lines to sine waves, thinking that trends will continue when they just don't. So that's our view on price. That's why, by the way, when we talk about investing, we did a Doom Zoom called Investing in Energy. We would not invest in the commodities directly, except during obvious times of Icarus Prince. The producers aren't really all that attractive to us. If we were forced to deploy in the energy space, we would want to be long companies that enjoy revenues that scale with volume, regardless of price.
Right. Midstream.
Yeah. Service providers, midstream, royalties, the classic plays, where to a wider extent, price doesn't matter. And volume is the key play. But that's if you force us to invest in the space again. But if you want the proof of all of this, just look at how many barrels of oil an ounce of gold buys over a 50-year chart. And if you plot that chart and you ignore COVID when oil went negative, so by definition, you know, went infinite, oil has never been cheaper in real terms, i.e. gold. You can buy, what, 40 barrels of oil now, something like maybe even more. It used to be between 10 and 20 for decades when, you know, the U.S. dollar was managed for such purposes. But that range was broken in the global financial crisis and has never been recontained.
Given how, what a slow moving and slow turning ship the energy production industry is or can be, is all of this, you know, current administration activity, is it just a nuisance to them, given you know, that they have 10, 20, 50-year plans?
So, no. There's, again, we warned of our industry friends that there's going to be some aspects of the Trump policies that you wouldn't like, that they would be bullish for volume, which is bearish for price, which is bearish for equities, right? And our view is stuff gets built during Republican administrations and money gets made during Democratic administrations. So they're going to be busy building everything they can. And by the way, the big players know that they're going to buy up all the small players now on the cheap. And then when it does come time for them to make hay, they're going to make a lot of hay. This is how the Exxons and the Chevrons have operated for decades. So they will take advantage of this window of having an oil CEO, an oil services, oil and gas services CEO in the Department of Energy's seat, and having, you know, the governor of North Dakota as the Secretary of the Interior. They will build a lot of things in the next 4 years. And you could build a lot of stuff in 4 years, especially if it doesn't cross federal lines and the EPA is not, you know, taking advantage of the Endangered Species Act to invoke federal power where none exists. So they will build a lot of stuff. They won't make a lot of money. And then when a Democrat comes in and everything gets put on hold again, well, what doesn't get put on hold is the demand for energy. And because of the inelasticity of that demand, they'll make a ton of money. So like Biden was the best thing for Exxon's bank account. It just wasn't the best thing for the ability to get big projects done in the U.S. So all of the projects that you had gotten done beforehand made a lot of money for you. And so there will be building now and there will be making money later. That's our view.
Much of what we're talking about hinges on whether or not all of this activity is a giant exercise in brinksmanship. To what extent do you think the current administration is actually going to go through with this? Because like the overarching discussion is, this is a negotiating tactic. This is to force people to the table. This is to, you know, confuse everybody and create, actually the intention is to create chaos and disorder so that people feel forced to, number one, look after themselves, like as in the case of Europe, which has been told, you know, we're not going to be responsible by the U.S. that is funding, you know, military support for the war in Ukraine, for example. Just the threat of these policies coming into play is enough to cause a recession, never mind the actual going through with it. I mean, how much of this is just play and how much of it is real?
Trump's a whirlwind.
Yeah.
Trump's had 4 years to ponder what he would do. and is operating at a speed that is probably not seen since FDR's first 100 days. If you pushed me, there's one overriding fear in the administration, which is the refinancing wave that's coming in the Treasury market. And once the signals are strong enough that they penetrate through Trump's inner circle to Trump himself, I think he will pull back from the brink. Judging by the market activity this morning, I think people are betting on a underwhelming set of tariffs from Trump today. Markets have been wrong. We might sound foolish by the time this publishes. But in the long run, whether it's today or in a few weeks or a few months, having reset the table to the extent that he can, the damage will become apparent, and he is nothing if not a political survivor. And they really have until the midterms to get anything reasonable through Congress from their perspective. It wouldn't sound reasonable to those who oppose his policies, but and so that has to be on his mind, that if we're going to do it, we have to do it now. If we're going to have a recession, we have to be coming out of it by the time next November comes around. And the people feeling the pain need to be, you know, sold a vision that things are on the upswing from here. So there's only so much time he could scramble the eggs before ruining the breakfast. And so I would, if you pushed me, given some of the people around him that I know, he's probably getting reasonably good advice. They have to know what industry's telling us. If they're telling us, like, they have channels. I think he blinks. And I think he and Carney, you know, we have this hunch we developed in December, which turned into one of our better calls, which is that Trump wants Carney in, right? And I think a lot of this, we even said at the follow-up piece we wrote on this, the first piece we wrote in December was called Alberta Clipper. And then the follow-up piece was called Unspontaneous Combustion. And at the end of Unspontaneous Combustion, we said, you know, look, gee, I think Carney's going to win. And I said, if we're right that Trump wanted him to win, look for the 51st state and governor talk to dissipate. And sure enough, last week in a post on Truth Social and describing a call with Carney, he called him Prime Minister of Canada.
Right.
That's no coincidence. And so I think he wants to hand Carney a win before the snap election on tariffs if he truly wants Carney in the seat. And so those two factors, it's, you know, April 2nd today. I'll always know it as April 2nd. Not Liberation Day. You know, the election's April 28th in Canada. If he truly wants to cement Mark Carney in the prime ministry, we could talk about why that is, but that was a long shot call when we made it. And the data has fallen in our favor. They don't always work that well, by the way, but we'll take the win. And so, you know, we'll see. So I think he wants to cut a deal with Carney. I think Mexico's played their hand a little better than Trudeau did, unless Trudeau was in on it. You know, who knows? But Carney's going to be the next prime minister of Canada, and Trump will be happy with that.
So we've got this in the sort of multipolar construct. You mentioned earlier your thoughts that, hey, we're having a tiff with our big brother as Canadians, but it's going to come around and just wait. And when you're looking at the U.S. turning its back on Europe, is that's different in your opinion? And I think I'm picking up.
Yeah.
I'll let you answer that.
Yeah, I think, well, here's just an interesting fact for you. To the best of my knowledge, no senior Trump cabinet member has had a phone call with a senior European Commission politician. Like, Ursula von der Leyen has not spoken to Trump, and the whoever it is that's supposed to be the, you know, the European Union's version of the Secretary of State, I think she's from Estonia, has not spoken to Marco Rubio. They don't have any time for the EU. I think J.D. Vance's speech will go down as pretty historic. It's like the EU is trying their best to prove him right. The Le Pen decision and all of that. And also, I think, between us, since nobody's listening, Trump doesn't like the British that much based on the whole Russiagate situation and his view of Keir Starmer and Starmer sending 150, Labour Party operatives to the U.S. to try to make sure that Trump didn't win. You know, the man is nothing if not vindictive with a long memory. I mean, I don't think that's a controversial statement. And if you look at the whole Russiagate fiasco all the way back in 2015 and trace it through to today, like much of the Ukraine war can be explained through that lens. I don't think that Trump has much time for the British. And that is sort of a story that we've been percolating internally and pondering how to write. Whether the British get back on sides with Trump or they just wait him out. I mean, who knows? But when we first started trying to understand Trump's behavior towards Trudeau in Canada, our first instinct was it must be that he's toying with the British, given that Britain and Canada still have this sort of very strong cultural and commercial relationship. And, you know, the governor general is still the official head of state and all that jazz. But then we concluded that, no, there's something deeper going on and that he actually wants Carney in the seat. And we've since developed a few hypotheses as to why that might be. But that the thought that he actually just doesn't have time for the British, like when he said to, this is a moment that almost nobody talks about, but he's sitting in the Oval Office with Keir Starmer and they're talking about, you know, Keir Starmer's, you know, is going to develop a coalition of the willing and all of this. Very interesting choice of words, by the way. And Trump looks at Starmer and says, well, you're going to take on the Russians by yourselves, and does a little check out this guy thumb move, right? Like he, you know, and the look on Starmer. Yeah, that's right. Exactly. Mike just did it. Like, can you imagine, like, what an insult to the British, right? And that was an insight. Like, Trump's actually pretty easy to read if you just observe him and listen to him. Right. He says what he means.
Yeah.
He says way too much, way too often, which in a way is kind of refreshing. But yeah, he's like, what are you going to take on the Russians yourself? Yeah.
I mean, get a load of this guy.
Are you kidding? You and what army, quite literally, was the name of a piece that you were thinking about, right? That's what we never deal.
You and my army?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. You, well, I mean, like, if you do an analysis of the state of the British military, I mean, well, there's a massive disconnect between the perceived power that the UK thinks it still has, the British establishment thinks it still has, versus the realities on the ground. Like, it must, back to the whole China and Russia and India have no technology, it's a techno-arrogance, as I called it at the time, when it wasn't popular or easy to say, but like, what's going on with Britain? I mean, Keir Starmer's talking about establishing no-fly zones over Ukraine like that, or a naval blockade of Russian commercial investment. You know what happens when you do those things, right? You go to war. Are you prepared to go to war with Russia? It's astounding. And by the way, like, British military spending is mostly pensions. And
oh God,
keeping up their nuclear. Yeah. So, like, they don't actually, they have a standing army of 75,000 soldiers. Literally one army. So anyway, we went off on a bit of a tangent, but it's really fascinating to watch. And I just think Trump has very little time for the Europeans. By the way, Ursula von der Leyen and the European Commission have successfully annoyed the Russians, the Chinese, the Indians, and the Americans, and the Brazilians. And they don't produce any energy. Interesting to watch. Yeah. And the Qataris, by the way, because the Qataris don't count their carbons with enough precision. This is really amazing to watch. And by the way, like, the whole rearming of Europe nonsense, which we said we would fade. I mean, yeah.
Let's talk about that. This past quarter, there was the announcement that Germany would take the foot off its debt brake, and the discussion around the rearmament, the spending of, $800 billion?
Euros.
800 billion euros, pardon me. On defense. And, in the context of the energy problems that Europe has, that seems like a tall order, right?
Yeah, we wrote a piece called Project Porcupine.
Right.
Because Ursula's grand plan was to turn Ukraine into a porcupine, a steel porcupine that no outside invader could ever occupy. So this is literally what she said. And so we just did a very simple analysis, and anybody could do this. Like, the information's there. So if you just pull up the old trusty statistical review of world energy, yes, it's 2023 data. Not much has changed. The 27 member block of the EU, which we would note does not include the UK or Norway, but we're talking about the European Union rearming using euros, printed presumably euros. Those 27 nations consume 60 exajoules of energy. Two-thirds of that total, or 40 exajoules, comes from oil, natural gas, and coal. And those 27 countries produce 6 exajoules of hydrocarbons domestically. So that means they have to finance 34 exajoules of energy a year before they decide they want to make a bunch of bombs and tanks and guns and bullets. What is 34 exajoules? That's roughly the entire size of the U.S. natural gas industry. The U.S. natural gas industry produces 37 exajoules, just to give you a sense of scale. So already, before they decide they want to rearm, they are starting with a bogey the size of the U.S. natural gas industry. And then in that piece, we showed charts of oil production, gas production, and coal production, U.S., Russia, China, and EU. And the numbers just blow your mind. Like, and so you and, like, where you get the joules. By the way, what are bombs? Bombs are highly concentrated forms of energy unleashed in a small area to do maximum damage. What is a tank? You need steel. What's going on with steel in Europe? But you cannot have heavy industry without energy. Europe has decided it doesn't want energy. So it has, by extension, decided, perhaps involuntarily, although that's back to the question of malice versus competence, it has decided it doesn't want heavy industry. But you can't have military might without heavy industry. And so China, we jokingly call China the new arsenal of democracy, because they produce all the weapons for the Western world. Like, they'll just stop selling us weapons if we go to war with China. But Europe in particular, at least the U.S. is a global energy gigapower, the strongest energy producer on the planet. What's Europe going to do? Where are they going to get the joules? And by the way, while cutting themselves off of the last pipeline connections to Russia, going to war with Qatar over their carbon counts and their net zero plans being insufficient, it's really just baffling. And so, you know, sometimes we get a little, we have a little flourish, you know, but there will be, this is how we ended the piece, quote, there will be no EU military surge of consequence. And if the U.S. truly does pull the plug on Ukraine, the war's end will swiftly follow. I mean, who are we kidding? Why we allow ourselves to pretend like what Macron and Starmer are saying to each other matters is really one of the great mysteries of our time.
And what is the runway for that kind of initiative?
It sounds like a timing mismatch.
Exactly,
right?
Yeah.
And we speculated in the piece that they would ultimately have to buy weapons from the U.S., which plays into Trump's hands because he wants to cut the Pentagon. And what a great way to keep the military and industrial complex satiated with printed euros from Brussels.
Squeeze play, right? I mean, that's kind of what I meant. Was that the intention of cutting off Europe?
Yeah, and I think they have eyes on adventures in the Middle East and in Asia. I mean, the thing about the U.S., which boggles the mind, is why we always feel the need to be at war with somebody. I don't get it.
War is peace.
Pondering writing a... Yes.
War is peace, freedom is slavery, ignorance is strength.
Yes, exactly right. We've always been at war with Russia, and now we're no longer at war with Russia. Possibly writing a piece about, you know, in praise of isolationism. Like, it's just the vast majority of people don't want war, and yet we always have them. So, yeah,
and
not to go too far.
What would be, yeah,
what were they even fighting about in Europe? Like, what does Europe have that would be the spoils of war? To be honest, I'm not sure.
I mean, if you're from Ukraine, this is an existential war, and from your perspective, it's a war of aggression by Putin, and Putin is evil. And I understand why people believe all those things passionately, and they should, I guess, if they live there and they've lost family members or their cities have been destroyed. This war is terrible. But like, I have a friend in Canada who was lamenting to me via text about how Trump was abandoning the Ukrainians and we shouldn't do that. And I asked him some very simple questions, like, why do you personally care who rules the Donbass? There's a war going on in the Congo with thousands of people being killed every day. Why don't you care about that? How did you come? Do you remember when you began to care who rules the Donbass? Would you send your boys to go fight for who rules the Donbass? Some people will be very annoyed at me posing these questions, but I think they're real. There's wars all over the world all the time. Like, we should be very selective about the ones we get involved in. And this New York Times article, this explosive New York Times article that basically admits that it was not a proxy war at all. It was the U.S. fighting a war with Russia using Ukrainian troops. Is outrageous. Like, nobody, Congress didn't, I mean, I guess Congress voted to support the weapons sale, so they had to kind of know what was going on. But there was no declaration of war on Russia. It's not how it's supposed to work. And Trump says, the two big, beautiful oceans, like, even take Taiwan. Like, why is Taiwan more important to Washington than you should reasonably expect it to be to Beijing? I mean, it's a artifact of, or the current situation is a result of an unfinished civil war, basically, in the minds of the Chinese. Very analogous to what the Korean border looks like. Okay. Do we want to go to war with China over Taiwan? Nuclear war, by the way, because both Russia and China are undeniably nuclear superpowers, especially Russia. It's like, then the counter is, well, if you don't stop Putin in Ukraine, maybe he'll march on Paris. It's been 3 years and he still hasn't captured the four regions that they claim are now Russian. I mean, it's sort of a contradiction in there, and you could say, like, by the way, when I asked the question, if we would say internally, we are willing to go to nuclear over the Donbass, okay, let's have that as a policy that we all agree on. And that the way you would manifest that policy is you would let Ukraine into NATO and then trigger Article 5. But we already have a policy that we would go to nuclear war over Russia, over Poland, because Poland's a NATO member. I would bet that Putin is probably not going to roll into Poland, given that they are covered by the NATO nuclear umbrella. Now, if we want Ukraine covered by the NATO nuclear umbrella, then we should debate that. We don't have that today, so we're trying to have our cake and eat it too, basically, which is, by the way, totally and completely unfair to the Ukrainians. I mean, no country and no people of any country has suffered more because of this war than the Ukrainians. Second on that list, of course, are the Russians. So I like, to me, war is always an abject failure of diplomacy. Always a failure of diplomacy. And so I'd like less of it. My view is that the U.S. and Canada enjoy a very good life over here. We have all the resources we need. We've got buffers of oceans. We have so little real enemies that we have to invent reasons to fight each other.
Yeah. Every week's a crisis.
Oh, boy.
Love it. Well, that is extremely insightful on the European remilitarization and regeneration of the industrial complex without any energy.
I mean, it is the stuff of, well, it's, we have a phrase for it. It's the stuff of spreadsheet dwellers, right? People who've only ever worked in a spreadsheet. Another great phrase is it works in universities. Yeah.
When did you realize people of the world know what's going on? When did that happen, Pete?
Didn't hurt.
It happened during the corporate world, right? Because the big inefficiency that we've hopefully taken advantage of in the market is that almost everybody from industry is buried behind a public affairs staff and an investor relations staff, and are basically afraid of saying the wrong thing for the wrong reasons in public, and so they just don't engage in the debate. But when I was in industry, and you sort of learn how the world works, like if you visited China, and you've seen how China operates, and then you come back and hear people who've never been to China speak confidently about what's going on over there, it's pretty eye-opening. Then it makes you wonder about the rest of the stuff they're saying. When you've interacted with, competed against, worked with some of the brightest people in Russia, you don't underestimate the Russian technical capacity and its manufacturing capacity. In fact, it's an amazing lesson that we failed to learn after two world wars, right? I mean, yes, you catch them off guard and then they roll over you. It's just, this is what happens. When you're in the real world and you read stuff in the paper or you listen to politicians who just have no idea what they're talking about, you realize that, in fact, the greatest example of this is the nuclear power sector. Complete and utter failure to manage the brand and the discourse. Like, no industry provides more benefit to more people with fewer downsides than the nuclear industry, and they get nothing but hate for it. Well, that's on you at some point. So,
I watched
the plight of the 0.999999. You always talk about it.
I watched this. I watched this very short video of a guy who was in the train station catching a train to Shenzhen, and he goes out of his way to say, I don't have my phone or my wallet on me, but I want to get a drink. So watch this, right? He goes into the store, the magazine shop at the train station, and he gets himself a drink, and he goes to the cashier, and he didn't need his wallet or his phone. He put his hand over a hand scanner and paid with his hand, with a hand scan. And it was WeChat. It was WeChat.
Yeah.
Which is...
In many ways, it's dystopian, and we should fear it.
The privacy concerns.
Gone.
The handprint, fingerprint, palm print privacy concern issue comes up immediately, but on the technology side, on the technological side, that ability to do that, to do things like that, maybe not that exactly, but is astonishing.
If you go to a BYD auto manufacturing facility, I remember seeing the BYD Frankenstein car in 08 or 09 at one of the car shows. It was literally a ripoff of the Corolla front to back. The interior was a potpourri of other people's technologies, but it was literally, we called it the Frankenstein car. And now they're the most prolific, technologically savvy, dominant player in the industry, and they're going to wipe people out. As we've argued, when you could take the best of everybody's technology and you don't have to pay to develop it, it's a very good head start to build from, which they do. And have done, but it worked. And one of the things we argued in WrestleMania is, maybe they've reached escape velocity here. So we'll see. And these companies are not capitalized; they just compete domestically. When I hear people underestimating Chinese technology, if my eyes could roll the full 360, they would.
All right, good. I wonder, you've also talked about, the idea we're heading for some creative destruction, a Schumpeter-like moment. And as we wrap up, we've chatted for a while, but I wonder what the world looks like on the other side of that if we actually get it right.
maybe like have a little optimism on a final note here, but yeah, like what?
Yeah, one thing
in New Albania, as that happens, what does it look like if we get away?
One thing we haven't talked about, and we haven't really written about, but we've dabbled in our private investing lives, is the whole AI space, and it's phenomenal and scary and mind blowing. Not only what's currently capable, but the pace of change. And we're reaching, like, and yes, I know there's a lot of frauds and scams and pumps and Ponzi's floating around in the AI space, and that always happens, and it happened in the .com era. But what I see firsthand, just in the few companies that we interact with, is mind-blowing, scary, but at the same time, such a profound shift in the economy itself that it's actually one of the reasons we haven't written about it is because we don't yet know how to intelligently do so. Like it's stunning what's going on. And by the way, even the small ways that we've incorporated it into our lives, like there's going to be people who are AI aware and everybody else very soon. And by the way, I think there's a lot of incumbents that are just going to be way too slow. This is not, the pace of change is not amenable to bureaucracy. One person can outdo teams at large companies that I won't name. And by the way, the open source AI is further ahead than what is being disclosed by the companies that we would all name. And I don't know how that lead ever gets shrunk. They just, there's just a free for all. By the way, no guardrails. Scary. Huge amount of fraud potential. And we're just scratching the surface. We're like in top of the first of what's coming. And so, and I do think the U.S. has a huge advantage. And by the way, British Columbia and Alberta have a huge advantage, even more so than the U.S. because it's cold there. Alaska might be a great place to build data centers too. We have this enormous, clean burning, abundant natural gas that you could just literally, and we've written this, envision distributed AI pods where natural gas goes in one side and data comes out the other. You don't need to connect to the grid. You don't need to connect to a pipeline. You just put your data center over the well and then you shift. Just think about it, right? And you send data around the world from there. Via satellite. I mean, all the technology exists, just hook up to space, you know, SpaceX and off you go. And so if you're, you know, what is the fundamental energy drain of compute? It's heat management. And so if I'm in British Columbia in the winter and I've got stranded natural gas that I can't give away for 80 cents a million BTU, why wouldn't I build a data center there? And so AI is going to disrupt so much that even in our discussion today, I think we're sort of, just because we're humans, we have this linear bias and it's very difficult to model exponential. And I know it's been predicted for so long that words like singularity and things like that have become cliche and corny, but I think it's real. I'm convinced. I wouldn't be betting on companies that are public today on it just because I it's impossible to predict, but we've done some dabbling in the private world for sure. And it does feel bigger than the internet. And I was around when the internet happened. We all were, of course, dating ourselves. This is much bigger, much more profound. And last point, which I think is bullish for us at least, is the value of uniquely human is going to skyrocket in an AI world. That's one of our contrarian calls that we think, because the very meaning of what it is to be human is going to be fundamentally probed in a way that makes a lot of people uncomfortable. And I think other humans will have the resources to pay for and will want that, which is distinctly human. And there's going to be a boom in distinctly human things. So we are pondering Doomberg's future. We're pondering our own personal lives, the lives of our kids through that lens. But it's coming. It's irreversible. The Chinese are just right there with us. But even the Chinese open source stuff is being left up by the West and vice versa. There's no barrier, tariff, information constraint that can stop it. it's coming. And by the way, every genius in the world is being connected into it. And soon AI will develop its own AI. Like, it's happening. Like, the best person I know in this industry has spent the last 18 months teaching himself AI using AI.
Yeah.
And is I think far ahead of OpenAI. And like, there's 1,000 of that person right now. And so it's coming. It's real. Just the prototypes we've seen, you know, like what it means to make an animated movie is over.
Right.
What used to cost you tens of millions will cost you hundreds of dollars. And this is happening at a pace of change that is unrecognizable across any prior supply chain development. And there are no technology supply chains that won't be impacted by it. And so there's a huge opportunity for disciplined execution to adapt to what's coming. And there's a huge threat to the bureaucracies that can't. And it's just all of it is being underpriced by the market today. I hope that was hopeful.
If it goes right, it's awesome. I don't know what.
Yeah, there are paths where it could go wrong. But I'm a you know, it's kind of Pascal's wager. Like, for all the heat Jim Cramer gets, he did say something very funny that stuck with me, and maybe we could close on this, which is anytime stocks went down because of a fear of a nuclear war, he bought them hand over fist, because who cares if I'm wrong, right? And so in my mind, you want to bet on the positive outcomes of AI, because if the bad ones materialize, it doesn't really matter what your portfolio is.
True.
That's a great note to end on.
Awesome. Bloomberg,
always awesome, always enlightening, always astonishing.
Well, I appreciate it. I really do enjoy our conversations, and thank you guys for being subscribers too. You know, we exist to delight our customers, and it's truly the work of our lives, and it makes it easy to talk for, you know, an hour and 40 minutes about stuff that you're passionate about doing. And so this is what we're meant to do, and our plan is to keep on doing it.
And where can, by now people know where they can find you, but where can they find you?
Yeah, Doomberg.com has everything.
Right.
Our articles, our pro tier, all of our podcast appearances are linked there. And paying subscribers should know that all of the comments to all of the pieces are read and answered to by me personally. I'm in the comments section for at least the first 2 days after a piece, going back and forth with subscribers, accepting critical feedback, rebutting a bunch of it at sometimes. But it is, you know, this is what we do. Every email gets answered by either me or the editor in chief, and I do the comments, and you know, we stand by everything we write, and we 100% believe what we write when we press send, which I think is important, and that can change over time. But when we hit send, we believe what we have just written. And we are true to that authenticity in our brand. We have written 365 articles, if you can believe it. And we never seem to run out of ideas. So.
Well, fantastic.
The target rich environment for ideas at the moment.
Yeah.
This, I guess, has been great. Talk to you again soon.